All right. At this time, we'll go on to item B. Mr. Mawad, would you like to introduce our very special guest today?
Yes. Good morning again, President Pauly, members of the board. We are very pleased this morning to have with us the executive director of the Sites Project Authority, Mr. Jerry Brown. Jerry has a long history across the state. He graduated from Cal State Northridge with a degree in mechanical engineering, and shortly thereafter, he went to work at L.A. Department of Water and Power on the power side of LADWP while he earned his master's degree at USC. In 1991, he started working for the East Bay Municipal Water District's Wastewater Division, where he worked there for about 9 years before he went over to the San Jose Water Company, and then ultimately to the Contra Costa Water District, where he became the general manager in 2010, and worked on a number of projects, including the Los Vaqueros Reservoir, that's noteworthy. In 2020, he became general manager of Sites, where he's made significant progress in advancing this critical project for the state. This is a crucial time for our water resiliency and water reliability across the state of California, and we feel it's important for us to hear directly from Jerry on the evolution of the Sites project, where does it stand, the long-term benefits, some of the challenges and the issues, and frankly, how it impacts all of us across the state. So with that, I'd like to ask Jerry to come up.
Welcome, and thank you for coming today. We've all been looking forward to your presentation.
Oh, I'm excited to be here, and it's my first visit to your facilities, and I wanted you to know that I'm very impressed, and the operation that you run here, from the looks of it, is one of the top-performing entities out there. And so happy to be here today to talk to you about this Sites Reservoir project, which is a statewide project that is of significance and is moving forward at a fast pace. We have a very significant tailwind at our back, I'm happy to report, at this time. And we do see the light at the end of the tunnel where this project can actually get built and implemented in the next decade. Let me try to figure out the...
I think if you just press anywhere on the screen.
Just press the screen? On the mouse. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the board, staff, members of the public, the Sites Reservoir is a facility that's located in Northern California, 500 miles away from here. Why does it matter to you? Well, it matters to you because it's an important element of what would be how we manage California water across the entire state, and it matters to you also, I think, because it would be an important partnership between the North, where a lot of the water is, and the South, where a lot of the water needs are. Second most question I get asked about Sites Reservoir is this one. What if we had Sites this year? How much water would we have been able to put into Sites Reservoir? And we've created this really slick optimization simulating tool, modeling tool, that has determined that in this past year we would have been able to capture about 700,000 acre feet into the reservoir. That's about the size of Diamond Valley Lake. That's about half the size of the Sites Reservoir. And that's a very substantial amount of water. And that is new water. That is not water that's being rediverted from someone else or recaptured. That is water that is currently going uncaptured and is flowing into the ocean. I keep hitting on the wrong button here, don't I? What am I doing?
Left click.
Left button?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There we go. Okay, first most asked question I get is, why is it taking so long? And that's a really good question, because this Sites Reservoir has been on the books for six decades. And I like to say that while it's true, that's a long time for a project to be under development. The current incarnation of the project didn't really start until 2010, which is when this Sites JPA essentially took over the project from the state and federal government and said, in order to get this project done, we need local support. And to have local support for this project, we have to have local leadership. And I'm sure you all can appreciate the reasons behind that. But this group of agencies here, these nine water districts in that local Sacramento Valley watershed, all came together and said, we're going to get this project put together. We're going to meet the needs of the local area first. And then whatever's left over, we're going to branch out and provide for others in the state. Sites is really unique in where it's located. I think that is one of the most significant attributes about the project. And because of where it's located, it is compatible with our water system in California, our major water facilities, Shasta Lake, Orville Lake, Folsom Lake, and it can operate in conjunction with those as opposed to being in competition with. So many things that we try to do are trying to compete and force against what we've already got. Sites is really unique in that it works in conjunction with what we have. It takes what we have and it leverages that and it advances that to the level that we need for a changing climate. I mean, when you think about Orville particularly, that's primarily a snow-fed lake. So as climate changes and we get predictions about the same amount of precipitation we normally get, more of it coming as rain instead of snow, that's going to be harmful to Lake Orville. But you look at something like a Sites Reservoir, where Sites is located and how it's fed off the Sacramento River downstream of the Shasta Lake, it's 100% rain-fed. So as we think about climate change, all of the projections, there's a whole wide range of projections that are out there. We've looked at all of them, and all those scenarios indicate that either with climate change, we're going to maintain the same level of performance that we're predicting today and seeing today in our simulations, or it's going to get better by another 15%. That's the kind of investment that we as a state need to be making in our water management to improve and address this impending issue that we have. This is a plot of where the reservoir is located. It's a 1.5 million acre foot reservoir that would be located just to the west of Maxwell, California, which is a small town that's about an hour north of Sacramento on I-5 between Sacramento and Redding. And it's a really beautiful location. I know Director Armstrong was out there. Thank you for coming out with the Metropolitan Director tour. And it's just a beautiful, perfect place for impounding water. And it's something that has been identified for six decades as that. There are very little in terms of facilities that are necessary to construct the reservoir. Another reason why the reservoir is so important and complementary to our water system is that it can rely on existing conveyance systems. So you see the two blue lines here that run up and down the page. Those are existing canals that are in the area that have fish-screened diversions on the Sacramento River today that are available for us during the winter months when we plan to take water out of the Sacramento River to divert and bring that water up into the reservoir. There's 180 miles of conveyance that's part of this project, and only about 15 miles is new pipe that's in the ground. That kind of illustrates for you how much we're relying on that existing infrastructure to get the water out of the river into the reservoir and then back into the river after it's being served. Beyond that, to move that water down to Southern California, obviously we're bringing the water through the delta and then into the California aqueduct, bringing it down into the Met system where it ultimately gets delivered here. So all of that is based on existing infrastructure as opposed to building new infrastructure. If we had to build all of this brand new, it would be far too expensive for us
Goodbye.
To afford. Goodbye. Hello. Keep going?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. This slide gives you a listing of all of the participating agencies in the project. And this is a beneficiary pays project. So if you're receiving benefits, you're paying for your share of the benefits of the project. And these are all of the agencies that are currently participating in the project. And I'll get into more a little bit in a minute how much they're participating. On here, though, I've included what we call our waiting list, which is really important because, number one, this tells us that there's a huge demand out there across our state for new water supplies. But number two, it says that if any of these existing participants wish to go in other directions, we have folks that are ready to go and waiting to take their place. So I know this is a little bit hard to read, but I wanted to give you just an understanding of the 22 water districts that are identified here as participants and the levels of their participation, along with the state and federal government. Metropolitan, your participation is through Metropolitan Water District as a member agency, and they are currently in the project for a 22% share of the project. So that is your participation in the project. I've also highlighted the state and federal government's participation here because this is not a state or federal government project. This is a local-led project. So all of these participating agencies are in the driver's seat. State and federal government wish to participate in this project as well, and so their participation is just like the others. They have a share of the project that they receive benefits from, and they pay for those benefits. When you're investing a little over $4 billion in something, it's important to know what you get out of that investment, right? So I like to make sure people understand what are the guarantees when it comes to investing in the Sites Reservoir Project. And there's two. Number one, you get a share of the storage space. So remember on the previous slide I showed how Metropolitan has roughly 300,000 acre feet of storage space in the reservoir. That is their bucket in the reservoir to manage, independent of everyone else. They get to manage that storage space. Okay. The number two guarantee is that you get a proportionate share of any water that's able to be diverted into storage. So you noticed that Metropolitan has a 22% share of the project. 22% of any water that's able to be diverted out of the Sacramento River in any year can be diverted for the benefit of Metropolitan and put into Metropolitan storage space. That's how it works. Now, how do these guarantees then translate to decisions that somebody like Metropolitan can make in their use of sites? So just taking 2022-23 sites filling, for example, 700,000 acre feet, 22% of that, 155,000 acre feet that Met could have put into their storage space. So basically filled their storage space about half full. If they wanted to, they could have said, well, we are going to forgo these rights and waive our ability to take this water, and that would then make that share available to someone else within the sites family. They could lease space from someone else if their existing 300,000 acre feet was full and put their 155,000 in that leased space. These are options that any of the participants have in their use of their share of the project. And, of course, everybody's got to work together and everybody's got to cooperate in how we do this and how that all works. The nice thing is that the capacities that we have accommodate everybody's needs, so we don't have limitations based on those factors. Of course, you've got to be able to get the water through the Delta, all right? All of our analysis that we've done to look at how a Southern California participant would get their water is through Delta conveyance, so this is not dependent on the Delta conveyance project or any tunnel project. All of the water would be moved through the pumps, export pumps, during the transfer window, which is about July through November. And because of the way we're planning to operate and a lot of the agencies are planning to use their water, the capacity exists because the water will be drawn into the reservoir during the wet period, saved for the drier periods. And it's during the drier periods when that capacity is available for moving the water into the service areas of the agencies. Financing. So our financing is pretty well lined up. Last year, we were noticed on a $2.2 billion WIFIA loan for the project from EPA. I think you guys have probably gotten WIFIA loans for projects you've done or other things you're involved with, but that's a big part of how the participants are intending to finance their project, and we're working with WIFIA right now and what that loan agreement looks like. Very competitive program. We've got a Prop 1 award 2018 for $875 million, so that pays for the state's benefits. Most of those are in the form of ecosystem benefits, so the state is going to use their space to divert water and serve water to ecosystem needs, and that's good for all of us, and that's what their portion is largely paying for. And then the federal government similarly has plans for using their share for either meeting ecosystem needs or some of their contractors' needs. What's really kind of lost in the weeds here is this: when you look at the state and federal components, you could be talking anywhere from 25 to 33%, a third of the project is delivering water for ecosystem purposes. And this is a point that I make often to people. We cannot be developing projects like these that are for our entire state and forget about the ecosystem or assume that everything that we're doing is just to meet the water demands of our customers. The ecosystem is going to be harmed by climate change just like our customers are. And we have a responsibility as water providers, as water managers, to deliver on those needs and not leave those out. So when we develop these projects like sites, it's an important element to the success of the project and to the accomplishing what essentially the taxpayers said they wanted when they voted Prop 1 into existence. This is a comparison of alternate water supply costs, and I know this will get everybody's attention because this is where it comes down to the money, and everybody's always worried about how many dollars is it per acre foot. And this table is not our table. This is the Pacific Institute's table. Heather Cooley put this out in her report here that's cited in 2019. So all this is in 2019 dollars. And I tried to put side by side here so you could see where sites lands in relationship to some of these alternatives, just to give you an idea. Look, I understand these kinds of things are very agency specific, and you have to look at these things based on your own conditions. But it's important that I think you get at least some understanding of where sites lies in the context of some of these alternative supplies. And you can see it's quite competitive. Quite competitive when you look at all of these different alternatives.
It clicked on audio.
I have to do that?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Do you want me to rejoin audio?
And close the box.
Close the box?
I can close those for you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, I just want to do a real quick update on a few activities that are going on, and then I'll take your questions. We are involved now in hot and heavy in our environmental planning and permitting. We're winding up. We are coming very close to a September approval of our final EIR, which is a big milestone in the project. We've been going now for 6 years in the environmental review process and have made significant adjustments and modifications to the project in response to the feedback and comments that we've gotten from members of the public. And we are ready to move forward on that. We are looking to be a beneficiary of the governor's SB 149 CEQA streamlining legislation. So you'll see some evidence of that coming very shortly. You may have heard that we applied for a water right, which is a critical component to the success of the project at last year and was recently noticed and most recently extended by 30 days at the request of North Delta Water Agencies. So that process is underway, and we're very excited because we're now at a point where the rest of the steps are pretty well clear and scheduled. On engineering, our work out in the field is continuing. We have geotechnical crews and environmental survey crews out in the field currently. The surveying and the evaluation of the land, about 14,000 acres that are being affected by the inundation of the reservoir. And a lot of the work is going on around the dams and evaluating the subsurface conditions to evaluate the design of the dams and the cost of the dams. This is really an important component for our investors. This diagram just kind of identifies how we're breaking down the contracting for the project. I wanted to include this picture because it's a beautiful picture and it really gives you a sense of the valley and how it can serve as an impoundment for water. On the real estate side, we have not yet activated any land acquisition. And that is purposeful because we have not yet reached a point of no return, quite frankly. That is going to be coming in the next 18 months, plus or minus, and that is when we will start acquiring land. We have very cooperative landowners, mostly. There's a few that are opposed to the project, but I will tell you, as I told Director Armstrong at the site visit, I think the large part of the opposition from some of those landowners comes from the fatigue of this going on for six decades. That and the fact that five generations of their family have lived in the Sites Valley, including the Sites family themselves that still live there, that they are making a bigger sacrifice to make this project available for the rest of us, and we need to honor and respect that. Finally, our schedule, we are in, as I said, just near the end of the environmental planning process and involved in the water rights process. Our plan is to be into construction in 2025. That is really the point of no return, when 18 to 24 months, when we go back to all of our participating agencies and get what's called the final decision to sign up and commit to proceeding with the project. That is, they have said they don't want to do that until they have a water right and incidental take permit and biological opinion, and that is when we anticipate those steps being completed. With a 2025 start, we're looking at a late end of about 2033 and an early end just at around 2031. So I'll conclude with that and happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Great presentation. I'm sure we have some questions. Director Armstrong, would you like to start off?
Yeah, no, I just want to start and just say thank you very much for coming down here and sharing it. And it's really helpful because I think when you talk about sites down here with others, everybody has a different understanding of it. And I think the more you can come down to Southern California and help give everybody the same story and the accurate story, the better it'd be. So I appreciate you coming down. It was great to see it. It was actually quite remarkable to go through that little valley and then see it open up and see the whole, or as much of it as you see from come through there. It's huge, but it was absolutely beautiful and gorgeous. And it was right after all the rain, so it was green. It wasn't brown like that. It was really, really amazing. But so a question for you. You mentioned that this isn't dependent on the tunnels for conveyance, but if the tunnels were constructed, would that in any way, do you see that in any way hindering the conveyance ability, or that conveyance ability would still remain even if the tunnels were constructed?
You know, the sites project itself has not done an analysis of how sites releases would work in conjunction with the Delta Conveyance Project. I know some of the participants are thinking along those lines and investigating those aspects. But from what I know about the Delta, having managed an agency in the Delta, there are possibilities with the tunnels for moving sites water, but they would require integrating that into all of our permitting and approvals. Right now, we're going blazing speed at getting this done without the tunnels. If the tunnels come at some future date, then there could be an adaptation to that from in terms of sites, and how that would happen and what that would how that would affect water service to those that are south of the Delta that are part of the tunnels, that would have to be evaluated by them.
Okay. And then another question, and then I have a comment. You have your partners and you have your waiting list. But your partners, I'm just curious if you have a sense of are the, all of those partners still, in your mind, 100% on board with it? Or are there some of them that you could potentially see, not participating in the project?
To maintain local support, it's really important that we have Sac Valley participants. About 25% of the service is to Sac Valley participants right now. $850 an acre foot is tough when you're in the Sac Valley and you're farming. But they're hanging in there, and they're very positive about sites. They went through a similar thing 50 years ago with the Tehama-Calusa Canal. It was really expensive, and they didn't see how they could afford it, and now they can't live without it. And so a lot of the generation that's in charge of the farming operations of these farms lived through that as kids, and they saw their parents and their grandparents go through that, and they appreciated it, that what they did for them as the next generation. And I think a lot of that is what's carrying forward as momentum for them. So that's the folks in the north. I think from a M&I perspective, that's mostly ag. From an M&I and a South of Delta perspective, I think it's going to come down to cost effectiveness. And as I said, that's going to be an individual agency perspective. I think a lot of M&Is like yourselves are very pressured to keep your rates as low as possible so that water can be affordable for people. And that's a very noble thing to be concerned with. And I agree with that. But that's going to be where the rubber meets the road, I think, for those participants. From what I see, delivered to Met System, $1,300 an acre foot is a pretty competitive price point. And equally important, a diversification that helps you to bring some of these supplies into the area that you've relied on for many years and are necessary to continue to grow your local supplies.
Okay. Just one final comment. I think you see how important Diamond Valley Lake is to us here in Southern California. And I mean, this is obviously twice the size of that. But I think with climate change and climate whiplash and all of the things that's being called, I mean, clearly storage is critically important to capture that. And that's new water that's going to be filling that reservoir. And, I think it's great that Metropolitan is a partner, and I think that is our participation if Metropolitan is a partner. But if Metropolitan was to fall out of that for some reason or decrease that amount, that's where I wonder if we shouldn't have been on the wait list or we should consider being on the wait list, either individually or as we talked about with our alliance group as well. I mean, it just seems to me that this is a big opportunity to evaluate and consider participating in if there's opportunity to do that. So I think that would be great if we explored more and the board could hear about options on that more. Thank you.
I know you're not asking me a question, but in recognition of the waiting list agencies coming forward, we included all of them in our water right application as a place of use. We're intending that they could be water transfer partners for participants should that water be available. You, as a metropolitan agency, are in our place of use, so you're already covered by that, and we would welcome you as a waiting list participant if that's what you desire to do.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I have no questions. I appreciate you coming down.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I had a couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
Number one, the question I have about the size of the site's reservoir and is the anticipated construction of it, is that like the ultimate amount of water that valley could potentially carry, or was it downsized because of potential environmental pushback? Or that's the first question.
Okay.
And the second question is, so all these folks that have been sitting around for six decades, and while they're all waiting, are they getting paid anything to just sit around and wait for a decision to be made? Or I mean, I could see the frustration that this latest iteration has been going on for 12 years, and they don't know if it's going to happen. It's not going to happen. As a landowner, it sounds like they're being very cooperative, mm-hmm. but at the same time, at what point are they going to say, you know, do something or get off the pot? You know, mm-hmm. those are my two questions.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, and one that others share as well. And I would say you're dead on. Yeah, it's time to go now. It's either going to happen in the next 2 years or it's not. And that's it. You know, we have to get to that point. On the point of the size, that's really interesting because six decades ago, when the Sites Reservoir was included in the 1957 Bulletin Number 3 California Water Plan, it was something like 5 million acre feet of reservoir space. It was called the Colusa Complex Reservoir, and more of it spanned into Glenn County than Colusa County. Now, almost all of it is in Colusa County, and it's shrunk over the years. 1977, it was 3.2 million acre feet. In 2017, when we put out the initial EIR, it was 1.8. Now we're at 1.5. And a lot of that has come, Director Corona, from sizing the reservoir relative to what can get permitted as a diversion out of the Sacramento River, and be protective of the aquatic species in the river, and at the same time finding a sweet spot for what we can all afford. There's this kind of push-pull on what can you get permitted versus what can you actually afford. And I think what was envisioned in 1957 was all about serving population growth for California, and even at that time, the reason why it wasn't built is because it's too expensive. We couldn't afford it. Number one, we didn't have the Tama-Calusa Canal at the time, so they didn't have that piece of conveyance. They'd had to build all that. That would have made it too expensive. So over time, things have evolved and changed to put us in a position today where we've right-sized the size of the reservoir to the permittable ability to divert water safely for aquatic species off the river. It's frustrating, but it's kind of the way, the evolution of things, and it's a development of thinking that I see as an important kind of learning lesson for all of us as we consider our own actions and other activities.
So does the timing of the annual filling of the reservoir, is it mostly timed to pick up potential rainfall coming in, or is it timed to capture what is being automatically dumped every year from Oroville and for flood control purposes? You know, Oroville is, you can fill it this high, but when winter comes, they're going to bring it down to here. Mm-hmm. And is it time to capture the rain, or is it both, or
primarily
that water just goes away?
Good question. Primarily, it's programmed to capture the rainfall. It's not depending on the releases from upstream reservoirs for flood protection. There would be opportunities potentially if those conditions occur, but that is not what the primary source of the water is. It's primarily when we get rainstorms across the Sacramento Valley and they dump a bunch of rain into the river. That's when we can pick it up, when certain flow conditions are met at certain points to be protective of the salmon in the river.
Okay.
So I just had one question. Again, thank you for coming down. I think I am a big proponent of sites.
Thank you.
I think you're the right person to finally get this done. As a taxpayer, as someone who supported Prop 1, I am very frustrated over the fact that the public said, go spend money on water projects, and frankly, we have failed to do so. So I'm glad that you're heading this up. But you mentioned the environmental community needing to be on board with this, and there's a benefit to that as we go forward. I know it's hard to predict lawsuits, but do you see a large litigation period over this before we can get to construction?
I hope not. I think
perfect
that,
answer.
I hope not. We're working as hard as we possibly can to not have that situation. I will tell you the changes that have occurred in the last 6 years to address some of the comments and concerns that have been raised have been painful for the investors, mm-hmm. and it's driven some of the cost up. But on the other hand, all of the concerns that have been raised have not been completely addressed because they can't necessarily be addressed to the extent that those parties wish they could be mm-hmm. or think they should be. So I think where we are today is right there where we can get something permitted and we can afford it. And that's probably the right spot we should be at.
Okay. No, but again, I appreciate you coming. I do think you're the right person to be leading this. And it's definitely critical infrastructure for the whole California water system. So, Joe, did you want to?
Yeah, President Pauly, again, I just wanted to express our collective appreciation for Jerry to come down and meet with our board and present. I did have one quick question, Jerry. I know you when you showed the participation, the pie chart, you showed the state and federal participation primarily for potentially environmental habitat mm-hmm. benefit. I'm curious. I know there's been questions about a priority system on access to the future sites reservoir storage. Would the state and federal or would the environmental benefits have a priority over other participants, the way you're looking at structuring the participation on sites?
The priorities would be based on a beneficiary pays principle. So, as I said, everybody owns their condo in the condo complex, including the state and federal government. So the deliveries for their purposes would be prioritized in conjunction with the priorities of all the other participants. So it's like thinking of it like the multiple Diamond Valley lakes all kind of pooled together, including the state and federal government having their piece. And I would say, you know, from the state's perspective, this is a really unique opportunity to have almost 250,000 acre feet of storage space and water, new water, that can be applied for ecosystem purposes upstream of the Delta. The Delta, in particular, is needing a lot of attention. The Sacramento River needs attention. All of these things will benefit from having this asset that can be flexibly managed to meet those needs.
Thank you for that. And President Pauly, if I may ask, at the
do a photo? Before?
Yes, we're hoping to do a quick picture with Jerry, if possible.
Nice. Yeah. Thank you.
We can get the board down here. And
we can ask the entire board members to join us.
Wow. It's an
honor.
Appreciate it.
We bought this fancy
logo. I know.
I'm going to
advertise
it now.
So.
Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it very much. All right. We will move on. We good? What's? Okay. So we're going to stop for, what do we think?
A couple minutes.
Oh, don't break the microphone. Was a nice catch. Okay. I know you. Okay, so 2 or 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Zoom. Enter your meeting ID followed by pound. Enter your participant ID followed by pound. Otherwise, you have entered the meeting as a panelist. Attendees can now hear you speak.
Okay. All right. The floor is yours.
Microphone. We're having some technical difficulties here. Okay. The last thing I want to do is drop this. Okay, great. So I'm here today to give you an update on digital wallets within the utility industry, have a brief overview of transaction fees, and then talk about next steps with regards to digital wallets. So if you told me you didn't know what a digital wallet was, I'd probably wonder kind of about your technological savvy. But on the off chance you don't know what a digital wallet is, it's an electronic payment platform that can be used from a computer or a smart device of a consumer's choice. Essentially, it's a portable payment option for you. So why use digital wallets? Our bill and payment provider, Kubra, did a survey in 2022 to understand why customers were using digital wallets. And many of them cited ease of use, it saves me time, I think it's convenient, and they also consider them to be more secure. And I can definitely validate the convenience factor. My husband has a bad habit of leaving his payment cards at home. He carries a very slim kind of payment or a card holder in his pocket along with his phone, and he keeps leaving it at home. And he keeps going out in the community and shopping. And so when he gets to the register and he tries to pay, he realizes he doesn't have anything on him, but his digital wallet on his phone has saved him time and time again. And you'd think he'd learn his lesson, but apparently not. And so we also found through this survey that many customers' digital wallet preference is PayPal, and I will absolutely validate that. Anytime I'm doing any shopping online and PayPal is offered at the time of checkout, I'm going to choose it. It's already in my phone. I already have all my passwords set. The transaction takes about 30 seconds or so, so it's definitely something that I find, you know, helps me as a consumer. And then also we found that many consumers prefer to use more than one digital wallet, and apparently I'm the average survey response person here because I also use Apple Pay on my phone as well. So I use both of those depending on what's offered at the time of transaction. In our research, we were pleasantly surprised to find that if a biller offers digital wallets, 25% of consumers will use them to pay their utility bills. And that was kind of a surprise to us. You know, we didn't know how prevalent it was in our industry. And then also consumers gave feedback that the reason why they're not using digital wallets is because their biller just doesn't offer it. So we did some research to understand similar agencies, kind of what were they offering as far as payment options. And of the 8 agencies we looked at, half of them do offer digital wallets to their customers, depending on, you know, what type they offer. But what we also found is that many agencies are considering implementing digital wallets to modernize their payment options for their customers. So what does that mean for EMWD? So President Pauly, you asked us to do some research on other payment option types such as Venmo and PayPal. So we partnered with Kubra to understand what did they offer as far as digital wallets, and we found they offered Venmo, PayPal, Google Pay, Apple Pay. You can pay via Facebook. That's apparently a thing. And if you have Alexa, you can tell her to pay your water bill. All of those things can be offered through Kubra, but it is via a custom implementation where you actually have to write custom code. But what we also found in our research is that KUBRA is currently developing a standardized implementation plan for all of their clients with regards to digital wallets. And the tentative implementation for that standardization is quarter one of 2024. So shifting gears a little bit, with the implementation of digital wallets comes the issue of transaction fees. So currently, EMWD pays the transaction fee at the time of transaction of the time of a customer's transaction to pay their bill. So all they are asked to pay at that time is just the billed amount. And with the implementation of digital wallets, the anticipation is that it is going to increase our transaction fees as a district. So to put that in perspective, these are payment statistics for 2022. And, you know, just to kind of summarize, we processed $282 million in customer payments. And of that, we paid about, you know, 0.5% of the money we took in transaction cost. And so with the implementation of digital wallets, the transaction cost is nominally going to go up. You know, it's similar to what we currently pay for a credit card transaction, as you can see in the table right there. But I think the important thing to remember is that implementing digital wallets ensures EMWD continues to deliver high standards of service to its customers. I feel like as an agency, we're known for that, and we strive to meet that in every aspect of our business. It provides a modern experience when interacting with EMWD, which is also something that I think we have been trying to achieve here as a district. And then lastly, it delivers on the triennial strategic goal of superior customer service through the use of technology to improve the customer experience. And so we also kind of had a question of the agencies that are offering digital wallets, are they assuming the transaction fee for their customers? And what we found by and large is yes, they were. You know, we did kind of a fact-finding, you know, mission at our recent customer service week where we asked other agencies, do you offer digital wallets and do you absorb the transaction cost? And largely we found that they did. This is very standard in the industry. So the next steps, you know, as I mentioned before, KUBRA is finalizing that implementation plan of standardizing that digital wallet offering for all of their clients. At that time, if project funds are required, we'll come back to the board and present our recommendations to implement digital wallets. We'll also work with PGA. We'll initiate a communication plan to advise customers of the new payment offerings just to make sure that, you know, they know that we have that as a payment method now. We would recommend at this time that the district would continue payment of transaction fees for our customers, as we have done historically. And then once digital wallets are implemented, we would report the results and then update the board periodically. So with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions on this?
No.
No, I just want to say thank you for the presentation. I asked for this because it's probably not the customer today or the next year or the next year, but it's the customer 7 to 10 years from now. If you're 19 years old today, you grew up having this device in your hand, and that's your world revolves around it, and that's going to be our paying customers in those future years. And I think we as an agency need to adapt to how people want to pay. Well, one, we want them to pay their bill, but two, we need to be flexible in how they want to pay that bill. And so I know that we still have people that come to that front desk with cash.
Yep.
And we'll take that, but I also want to be able to take the digital wallet transactions of the future. So I appreciate the presentation, your research very much. I'm glad that our vendor partner is keeping up with modern times too and will be able to accommodate us. So thank you very much for that. Going to item D, which is battery energy storage systems and solar opportunities update.
Good morning.
Click to advance. Okay. Thank you very much, President Pauly, members of the board, executive staff. Before I start, I'd like to introduce David Burdick. He's with Terra Verde, the district's consultant who's worked with us for many years on many of our solar projects, energy projects, and currently the battery energy storage project that we're working on now. So thank you, David. Appreciate it. So I will begin. Let's see, did I do that wrong already? Here we go. So just a quick overview of our current energy portfolio. Across 19 separate installations, we have about 22 megawatts of capacity, producing about 50 million kilowatt hours a year, roughly a third of the district's usage. And to put that in some context, 50 million kilowatt hours a year would power about 4,000 average-sized houses. So that's a lot of power. And we'll jump right in to our battery energy storage systems. So back December 15th of 2021, the board approved for us to move forward with the battery energy storage systems project. And with that, we were able to secure $5.5 million of funding through the self-generation incentive program to largely offset the cost of those batteries, with the expected savings of about $2.7 million over 15 years. We started out with six projects, two at Hemet Water Filtration, one at Sanderson Lift, two between the Temecula Valley and Paris Valley, RWRF and Sun City. Initially, the second battery installation at Hemet Water Filtration was approved. However, after further review longer in the process, SCE determined it wouldn't receive funding because they can only authorize one project per address per meter. Hemet Water Filtration is a unique situation. They have two electric meters there on the same address. So the second battery was canceled. However, we are looking at an alternate installation, which I'll address here in just a minute. So how are we going to achieve those savings? Quite simply, the batteries can be connected to the grid, Southern California Edison, or solar to charge at the lowest cost of power portion during the day, typically 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., and discharge when power is more expensive between 4 and 9 p.m. in the afternoon. While these are under SGIP funding to provide backup, 4 hours of backup during a power outage, we'll mostly be using these to peak shave. So where a facility might have 300 kilowatts of demand, the battery would release power to offset, let's say, 100 kilowatts of that demand so that the draw on the grid would only be 200 kilowatts, and essentially that's peak shaving. That's where we'll realize our savings, the $2.7 million. So a quick update on the progress. To date, we have three batteries installed, Temecula, RWRF, Hemet Water Filtration, and Sun City. We're expecting permission to operate, to turn them on, permission from Southern California Edison, by August of this year. The remaining two installations, Paris Valley RWRF and Sanderson Lift, have actually started construction. They have mobilized on site, and they'll start here by the end of July, putting down concrete, getting them ready to set the battery. You can see the batteries are quite large. They're about 8 feet wide, 8 feet high, 20 feet long, and come in at about 55,000 pounds. 2 megawatt hours each with a built-in 1.5 megawatt hour inverter. So it's quite a bit of power. So speaking to the additional opportunity we may have, San Jacinto RWF, we're currently looking at that as an alternate installation because of the canceled Hemet Water Filtration. There's roughly $1.98 million left of SDIP funding with that Hemet Filtration cancellation that we could use towards the San Jacinto RWRF. So it wouldn't require any additional project funds. It'd be funded wholly by the SGIP. And we're hoping to have a final decision on that by the end of July, and then we'll come back to the board to present our findings on that, whether it's an opportunity to move forward or not. Before I jump to the solar, any questions on the battery? Okay, no. Moving forward, solar opportunities. So back in July, we notified the board of pursuing potential additional solar opportunities, leveraging a study that Terra Verde had done previously, where we looked at all 260 or so Southern California Edison accounts for a viable location to install additional solar. With that, we whittled it down to 36 locations for a deeper dive, considering, you know, is there enough land to even install solar? Are there future capital improvement projects that might need that area in lieu of the solar? And then the load profile of those facilities. Following that, we were able to narrow down to 4, Well 92, Well 84, Paris Valley RWRF, and San Jacinto RWRF, a deeper dive on the viability of solar at those. And project findings. So after reviewing all that, it is not recommended to move forward at this time on additional solar opportunities, and there are several factors that played into that. One key aspect that Terra Verde has shared with us and included in the study, for it to be a project to move forward on under a cash purchase scenario, you want a payback within 10 years, or under a PPA, a payback of less than 1 year. None of the four final locations met that criteria. A couple contributing factors of that, the large capital investment that was required, a lot of the site work that was needed at both the San Jacinto and Paris, $1 million and $2 million respectfully for those. The economies of scale, some of those were a little bit smaller installation, and without the economies of scale, the cost of materials is quite high. As with most things following COVID, labor costs and material costs have increased significantly, factoring into that. And then the transition from net energy metering 2.0 to 3.0 required quite an aggressive design and construction timeline to be grandfathered in under the 2.0. And two, I forgot to mention, PPA pricing has gone up quite a bit too. In comparison, our current PPA installations hover just under 6 cents to just over 7 cents a kilowatt hour, which is a fantastic rate. PPA numbers now aren't below 10 cents, and some as high as 24 cents. So quite a bit of contrast between prior PPA rates and current PPA rates that we're seeing on the market. But not to say that we won't keep our eyes on the market, keep our eyes on the solar, where it's trending, and should future opportunities become available, we'll be the first to come back to the board with those to present. So with that, any questions on the solar?
I got a question. Corona? Why do you have to have a payback in 10 years? If you're paying cash for it and you're buying it, why do you have to have a payback in 10 years? You may get your money back a little slower, but what's the difference?
That's an excellent question, and David is will be happy to
answer that. Great question. So the district's discretion and how it wants to think about long-term horizon for its investments, that's really your decision to make. That 10-year benchmark is one of the milestones that we look at as we're looking at financial performance for projects like this, and that has to do with how the modeling relates to the various levers that are kind of being pulled on to present those financials. So at 10-year payback, you're really subject to the kind of shape and the scale of kind of how the electricity market shifts over the next decade. So within a 5 to 7 year payback window, there's a high degree of confidence around how the electric rates are going to impact the economics of that project. As you get into 10, 15 years, you're beyond the half-life of the asset and exposing yourself to what could be a different trajectory. For example, in the state of California, we have a pretty wild, dynamic, shifting market environment with energy. There's a substantial amount of increased load that's expected, and while energy can be produced at a cheaper and cheaper rate, there's a substantial amount of investment coming for transmission and distribution to serve all of that increased demand. And so while energy prices may continue to hold or moderately increase, transmission and distribution costs are expected to go up tremendously. How those costs could be offset by projects like this in the future as we get past that 10-year mark, there's some degree of uncertainty. So it's about kind of the level of risk associated with these future expected benefits. So we take a conservative approach when we're helping our client customers understand kind of the financial profile of these projects, and that's where that 10-year recommendation comes from.
So I guess in another way, Director Corona, is that you take on a greater risk when the payback period is beyond 10 years, just because of the tariffs by Edison, the cost, the way they're going to potentially change the tiers and the time windows. I mean, we've seen some of that already happen in the course of our solar investments. We originally had significant investments made in solar, and the time windows shifted by Edison. Unfortunately, we were grandfathered in.
Yes.
Not sure that will occur in the future if the grandfathering provisions will be provided. But essentially, it's greater risk. It's greater uncertainty that we would have a return on our investment. So we in working with our consultant, we established that 10-year horizon. Not that we can't go beyond that. You know, if it's 11 years or 12 years, we could consider it. But once you get much further than that, truly, you are exposing a risk that we would not get a return on our investment. And that's the rationale.
Other questions?
Well, I'm remembering back when we did a little deal over there at Rancho, and Edison, we did the electrical stuff, and then Edison went ahead and changed their whole program, and Rancho ended up in a lawsuit with Edison on it. But I'm just thinking, this is not a one where you've got someone who's leasing you the facility, leasing it. Is that what you're talking about?
Yep.
Or is it where we actually buy the stuff, we build the stuff, and we own it all?
That would be the cash purchase scenario where you'd want the less than 10-year payback. That we're, like, our Phase 3 solar is under a power purchase agreement, so we're just paying for the power that it produces. That would require less than a one-year payback. But, you know, as Joe and said, the market volatility, the unknowns past that 10-year window where electricity will be in it. You know, speaking to your Rancho Water, we have a similar RESPCT project here where, following the application, SCE changed their time of use, which seriously impacted the value of the output of that power. And we burned the settlement agreement with that too. But something very similar could happen if we were to purchase a solar system with cash. You know, you amortize the cost per kilowatt hour based on the entire capital outlay for that. Let's say hypothetically it comes to 12 cents a kilowatt hour over the 25 years. Well, we don't know where Southern California Edison is going to be in 11 years, 12 years, 13 years. It's possible that they could provide power at less than that rate. So without having that payback under 10 years, there's a lot of volatility, unknowns.
So you think that Edison is going to lower prices?
Give me a comment.
Yeah.
Highly unlikely that utilities are going to be charging less for electricity, but it is...
Oh, I'm being facetious.
No, but it's highly likely that the mechanics of how they're charging for power and how that will impact the value of self-generation, that's where you're exposing yourself to greater risk. So, for example, already in the state of California, the net energy metering rules have changed. They're no longer offering retail credits to self-generating projects like what these would have been. They're only offering what's effectively wholesale rates, where you're getting two to three cents per kilowatt hour for anything that you supply to the grid in real time. And so that's an example of a dynamic tariff shift in the state of California that has occurred. So I understand
maybe
the mentality.
What we should do is just buy a bunch of these 55,000-pound batteries and not sell anything, not give it to them. Just we use it ourselves.
No, that's a great point, Dr. Corona. So I think to your point, we believe that in the future, as the tariff structure continues to shift, investing in additional battery storage actually is going to make more and more economic sense for us. That's exactly it. Whereas, again, for solar, as they change the tariff structure in the windows, it would be in our advantage to invest in more storage. So we're going to keep looking at that. I mean, we've got the four battery projects right now under construction, and three of them will be in operation next month. I think it's just a great effort by the entire team. I think it's these kind of programs that we've invested in that help shield our ratepayers from the uncertainties of increases in power cost. You know, we were talking about inflation not too long ago. These are one of those programs that helps us shield our ratepayers from the high cost of inflation. So we're going to continue looking at battery storage, and we're going to continue to look for opportunities for those investments. We're also going to continue looking at solar, but we realize that sometimes the shifting tariff structure by Edison may not make those every opportunity economical, but we'll certainly continue to monitor it.
Other questions?
Nope.
So let me ask you one. And at first, great job on this. I love the fact that we have analyzed and exhausted all possibilities on current solar. Because I get asked all the time, why aren't there solar panels on top of your water tanks? You know, and I like to say, we've looked at it. it doesn't make economic sense for you, the ratepayer, at the moment. But given our unique property structure, what do you think about an analysis of wind, of potential wind projects?
That's a good question. That's
why I asked it.
Phil only asks good questions. So, I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Understood. It's definitely something we could take a look at. Something we could definitely evaluate, as we did with the solar and battery storage initially.
And just something to keep in the back of our mind, because I look at, again, you know, with our treatment plants, we have a lot of unique land opportunities there that are way enough from neighbors. That's, you know, the problem with wind is some of your neighbors don't appreciate that as much. But anyway, something to keep in mind in the future, because I, as Director Crone has rightfully stated, our energy costs are not going down anytime in the near future. It's a big part of what we do. I love the fact that we're looking at some battery projects, because you're right. If we can generate it, I don't necessarily need to put it into the Edison system. If we can keep it ourselves and use it ourselves, I want to be able to do that. But at some point, we may want to take a look at if we have a portfolio for potential wind projects, too. So, all right.
So our sewage treatment plant over there in Temecula would be a perfect place for wind. It blows 30 miles an hour every single afternoon.
No. Just thank saying. You. Great presentation. Appreciate it this afternoon.
Thank you all.
All right. That will bring us to item 8, which is to receive and file various reports. I'll make a motion for it. Director Lawson will second it. Can I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Cronin?
Aye.
Director Lawson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with director record absent. That will bring us to our calendar review. Good morning,
President
Tammy.
Pauley, members of the board. I have a few events for your consideration this morning. The first one is scheduled for Friday, July 28th, and it's the Southern California Water Coalition quarterly luncheon. As a part of our membership, we have 5 complimentary seats, and that's taking place in Carlsbad. Followed by Thursday, August 17th, we have the State of the City for the City of Moreno Valley, and that's in Moreno Valley. And moving on to page 2. Is for your review, the board members' master calendar for the next 2 weeks. If you could please review that and let me know if you have any updates or edits that are needed. And moving on to page 3, the upcoming scheduled events we have first is Friday, August 4th, is the Jamil Dada Character Excellence Youth Awards taking place in Riverside, and we have you, President Pauley, scheduled for that. Friday, August 11th, the BIA's Southern California Water Conference in Ontario, and Pauley and General Manager Mawad are scheduled to attend that one. Wednesday, August 23rd through the 25th, we have the Urban Water Institute's annual conference taking place in San Diego with General Manager Mawad there as well. And Saturday, September 9th, is the Science Under the Stars event in Hemet. And General Manager Mawad is attending that as well. Following that, we have our upcoming board meetings and board committee meetings, which are all scheduled to take place on schedule. And moving on to page 4, we have the joint interagency meetings. And just wanted to remind you that this Thursday, the July 20th meeting, which was scheduled for tomorrow, has been canceled. And we had rescheduled the Elsinore Valley joint meeting to August 9th, as you recall. Just a reminder, out of office, we have President Pauley's going to be out of the area from July 21st through the 26th. And our district offices will be closed for the Labor Day holiday on Monday, September 4th. And if there are no questions, that concludes my report.
You could put me down on August 17th, State of the City, okay. Please.
Will do. Thank you, Director Slauson.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Let's go to Director's Activities Report, and we'll start Director Armstrong.
Okay. Just a couple updates on metropolitan meetings. The General Manager covered the Los Alamos Hills area, but Metropolitan is looking to implement this fall or winter I guess, a complement to the turf rebate program, which will be a tree rebate program, where customers can elect to, when they remove their turf or instead of planting plants, plant trees, and you get a $100 rebate for per tree. You can do up to 5 trees. They have to be at least 15-gallon trees, and they can be fruit trees as well. So I think that's a good addition to the program, and look forward to that happening. I did get the opportunity to attend a Met apprenticeship program graduation event that was at Diamond Valley Lake. And we had one of our employees. We have 3 employees participating in it. One of them graduated. His name's David Jimenez. And a really great event. And it was special to see. I mean, it was a very serious event, and the graduates were very serious about it. They had their families there, their spouses with them. And so I'm glad to see that we're participating in it. And
only once.
What's that?
We're the only member agency of Met that participated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a great program. I think more member agencies should participate. Of course, we had our Inland Caucus meeting to cover the Met board meeting agenda. And then EMWD meetings, Quail Valley Septic to Sewer Project Community Meeting. That was last week. We have another one tonight. And so this is about converting the septic in the Quail Valley area over to sewer. And we're entering the design phase of that project, and we need to access all the property owners' properties so that we can take a look at where their septic system is, and we can design in the laterals that are going to be needed. But had one meeting last week. There's probably 80 to 100 people there. It was really well attended. Our staff did a fantastic job explaining the project and the need to work together at this point. So again, another meeting tonight, and the goal is we need to get, I think there's 400 properties, 500 properties. We need to get those property owners to give us access to their property so that we can do that. And anyway, staff did a fantastic job there. And then the Cal Desal meeting, just routine things, but they are continuing to advocate for funding and more funding for desal projects, ocean or brackish groundwater, and the various assembly and state bills that are being considered. So that's my update there. Thank you.
Very good. Director Corona.
Okay. I did not attend the Murrieta Temecula Group meeting. The Army Corps of Engineers signing event was great. And Rancho Waters meeting, I attended that. Give a very short presentation, I guess you'd call it, on the Fallbrook Rainbow issue. That's all I have.
Very good. I had a productive meeting with April. We started discussing, I don't know if you're aware of this, but in 2025, Eastern's going to turn 75 years old. I noticed the other day Disneyland turned 68 years old. We're much older than Disneyland. But I wanted to make sure that we're starting to plan for some 75th year activities along those lines. So I had a very productive meeting with April on that. U.S. Army Corps Engineers, Joe's covered again, great partnership. That was a very good event. Had my usual meeting with the general manager. And then Winchester Mac was dark this month. So, Director Slauson.
Yes, I did not attend the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce meeting. I did have breakfast with our general manager, went over all a number of different issues, especially this agenda. And yesterday at SAPA, we adopted a revised conflict of interest code, and a revised salary schedule, and we authorized the submittal of a planning grant application to Office of Planning and Research on the Integrated Adaptation and Resilience Program. That's it.
All right.
And Rachel Gray is heading up that program.
Very good. Director Record, did I hear that you are back with us?
I'm back with you, and just wanted to report that my monthly update with the general manager on July 13th was a very good meeting.
Very, very good. With that, we will go to director's comments and the future agenda items. Anybody have? Okay, very good. I understand then, Mr. Legal Counsel, we have a need for a closed session.
We do, Mr. Chair, pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.
Very good.
Take a minute.
We will
to
take
transition.
A minute to switch over to closed session.
Okay, we're ready.
Are we back in open session?
Yes.
All right, we are back into open session. May I get our legal counsel to report out of closed session, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board met in closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9 to discuss one item of potential litigation. A discussion was had by the board. No formal action was taken by the board. That concludes my closed session report.
Very good. With that, we will stand adjourned until August 2nd.